This is the Knowledge Bandits Podcast, and I'm your host, Arun Galadima. Let's start the show.
This is the Knowledge Bandits Podcast, and I'm excited to bring you today's guest, Ayodeji Rotimwa. He's a freelance journalist who covers culture, development, and innovation across Africa and on the African continent. He has been published by CNN, Forbes Africa, The Mall, and Guardian, The Africa Report, amongst many other places. Ayodeji, that was just a very brief introduction, but I'd like if you could take time to let the bandits get to know you a little bit better.
So first of all, thank you for having me. I guess the first thing I would say, well, pretty concise summary for what I do, basically. But if I was just expanding this a bit, is to just say I started actually working in a local newspaper in Nigeria called The City Newspapers, where I worked for 5 years before I then started freelancing full time. And when I started there, I actually started in sort of the magazine department, which was kind of like a fashion lifestyle supplement. But eventually, the content there started to bore me, right? And I decided to sort of expand a little bit and sort of pitch my tent with other, in quotes, serious publications, which is where I then published by Forbes, and then it kind of grew from there. And initially, the plan was just write, cover basically culture, the arts, lifestyle, more or less. But that changed last year when I was set up into a fellowship for data and investigative journalism, and I was exposed to like sort of more pressing, I would say, topics. Okay.
So, I mean, I'm hearing you said you started in the like lifestyle or whatever, some things, topics that weren't necessarily as pressing. But what was the journey like in terms of moving throughout that? And I guess even before that, what drew you to journalism in the first place?
So I got into journalism quite by accident. So I've been writing since I was about 9. I think when I was 10, I wrote a really bad book about high school relationships, something silly like that. And so like I was very like huge on like literature and English and things like that. So when I got into university, that kind of stopped. I kind of lost the interest. But in my service year, NYC year, I don't know if your listeners are familiar with this, but the compulsory national service year for university graduates in Nigeria. So I posted to like the Far East in the north. So I was posted to Yobe. Yobe is now like literally a no-go area for everyone because of Boko Haram. But then Boko Haram hadn't spread quite as far there. So Yobe, it's a very desolate, lonely place. Like there was literally nothing to do. I was posted to a local government where I was supposed to be a secretary, but local governments people only worked there once a month. So there was nothing to do. So out of literally nothing to do, I started going they had a medical center, they had a library. So I started going to the, to read, to just, keep my mind busy. And I had seen like a call in the newspaper for comments, for readers' comments. I think it was on the Arab Spring, for readers to send their, their views on why they think it is, if there are any parallels to be drawn in Nigeria, blah, blah, blah. And I sent in a piece, thinking, of course, I didn't think it was good to get published. I thought, mm-hmm. I might as well just do something while I'm here. And it got published, mm-hmm. So I was very, very shocked by that it got published. But when the insurgency started to spread towards where I was, but then they started burning churches, it was also during election time, it was a very fraught period. It was burning churches, they were killing, some coppers got killed. So I had to be redeployed to Lagos. Right. So when I was redeployed to Lagos, I had 6 months left on my service here. So, and at the time, a friend of mine was working in this day newspapers. So I just felt, I might as well just, again, kill some time and then go, because I studied international law and diplomacy in university. And the plan was to be, to go to the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, work my way up, become a diplomat, blah, blah, blah. But that didn't quite work out. The whole NYC sort of sidetracked all of that. So while I was redeployed to Lagos, for the next 6 months, I applied to work at the newspapers, just kill time, and I just never left. but I had no plan whatsoever to become. I didn't even think it was possible to write like for a living. And I didn't even like journalism was not something that was like on my radar at all. That's how I started. But in terms of how I moved, so when I did start working there, I had, because I just felt like the state of like, I mean, while I didn't want to be a journalist, I was aware that the state of like journalism or just the press could be, I mean, the quality could be better. Even then, I mean, I was a huge fan of like the New Yorker, Vanity Fair, and blah, blah, blah. So I felt like we could have a version of that, which is why I actually chose to work in the magazine department at the time, because I wanted to create something. I wanted to like be in a place where I could, you know, gain the knowledge, build the contacts, blah, 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 and, you know, build from there, which is why I started in the magazine department. But after, I think in my second year, I just kind of got bored with it because it was the same thing. It wasn't very challenging. I think maybe because what I was reading and what I was exposing myself to at the time was at the same pace as kind of work I was doing. Like, I didn't feel like I was being pushed enough, which was when I then pushed myself, you know, to start like writing other things or challenging myself on other things. That's how I, you know, found my way to what I'm doing now.
Yeah. And so for many of us who, I mean, we've heard the term freelance journalism. We probably, I mean, I don't know exactly what that entails, but can you just give a rundown on what freelance journalism is?
So I guess colloquially, a freelance journalist is somebody who doesn't have a job, doesn't have a full-time job. Basically, that's what it means. No, but otherwise, what it basically means is you're not, well, more formally, I guess I would say, not necessarily tied to one paper. So typically when you write, when you're a journalist, if you're a journalist, like it's typically like any other job, like, you know, a banker or whatever. So for instance, when you work in a bank, when you work in GTC, you can't go and work with, you can't be working in a damn bank at the same time. But a freelance journalist is the opposite of that. So freelance, you, it allows you to be a roamer, so to speak. You can write for publications as you like. So you're not necessarily tied. You're not contractually tied to anyone. So, you know, magazines, newspapers, always need contributors. They might need somebody who, for instance, the paper is based in Lagos, but they need a story from Yobe. You happen to be based in Yobe. I mean, they might as well just use you, you know, to get the story that they want to get, since they don't have the resources to get somebody from Lagos to come to Yobe. That sort of thing. So that's what a freelance journalist is, kind of like that sort of a go-between, and somebody who just kind of roams, which is why I'm able to write for like, on any given month, I'm able to write for like two or three platforms at once.
Okay. And so, I mean, you touched a little bit on this, but typically, is there a publication that puts out something and says, we're looking for an article in this particular area on this subject matter, or do you just write and it's picked up by them? Or do you have to build
typically how we work? So, yeah, how I work or how I started freelancing is, or I guess also to answer the question, is so I pitch stories. So pitching is basically writing proposals to publications to say, oh, I think this is interesting. I think your readers will be interested in this. I think this will, you know, make good content for you. I think, you know, you can get traffic from this or whatever. I think this is like just a good story that you should chase. And then they discover that it's interesting as I have proposed or not. So that's how I typically write. Sometimes you're commissioned. So commissions, if you're familiar, if you have built yourself up to a point, that happens sometimes, like with me, the way your name and the quality of the work or otherwise that you put out is familiar. So you can find editors who will reach out to you and say, oh, you know what? We are interested in writing this story. We think you're either an expert in it or you can do a good job of it. And they reach out. But starting out, you have to pitch. And I still do that till today. Okay. Even though I've been freelance writing for a while now, like I constantly, it's literally like it's every week. On the average, I send at least two pitches out every week.
Oh, wow.
You know, it's can be intense sometimes. Because there's no room to be, I guess, to be comfortable. I mean, yeah, some freelancers do have like steady, you can have like steady workflow where you're constantly being picked up, but yes, that takes a while to like sort of build up that, that point where you're the one being looked for, not you pitching to people. Until then, like you literally pitch. So I still pitch.
Yeah.
You know, every week for stories. Yeah.
Okay. And
so, I don't know if that answers your question.
Oh yeah, it does. So let's see. When you first started out, I mean, what was that process? Who were you picked up by? And what was that process like?
When I first started out, so I guess one thing, even I came to the realization quite late, so to just sort of leverage, you know, you know, I guess network, I just, even though I have a weird relationship with that word. So I think my first piece I pitched to Forbes Africa, because I knew that they had, while it was a business magazine, they had like an art and lifestyle section. And then the business of art is something that is not talked about quite as much. And I thought it was an interesting angle, you know, business magazine talking about how, you know, people, the business of visual art or the arts and things like that. So I had just, reached out to, a colleague that was actually a public relations professional, but I knew obviously because he had, you know, contacts with international magazines to, you know, to connect me to the correspondent at Forbes. And that was how that happened. And I just, you know, sent my ideas and she liked it. She's not there anymore. She liked it at the time. And they just, they ran with it. I guess that maybe the lesson to draw from that or how that process starts, it just sort of, I guess I'd say using what you have. So just building, you know, a network, so to speak. So because I knew that PR professional because I had actually worked in a magazine, but they had also put stories to me, you know. So I don't know, I guess also maybe being in the right place. Yeah. That answers your question, but
yeah.
That's kind of how that, that journey went. Yeah.
Okay. And so, let's see, is freelance journalism your full-time job?
Freelance journalism is my full-time job. However, so I run a very small communications business on the side because I believe in this Oprah Winfrey quote that says, do what you have to, you can do what you want to. I don't kid myself that freelance journalism, because some months are really good, some months are really bad. So
yeah.
It can be a very yo-yo system. So for the communications business, which is like digital marketing, social media, proposal writing, newsletter writing, anything that's the creation of communication materials for SMEs, more or less.
Yeah.
Or, no, actually not necessarily SME, but businesses I've worked with are either nonprofits or creative businesses.
Okay.
So I do that on the side as well, which is like a steady and more, you know, end of the month, you get the check is coming in. So that sort of gives you kind of like security and a balance to then, you know, be creative and think about, you know, pitches and story angles and things like that. Because if I was worrying all the time about where the money would come from, I wouldn't have the strength or the energy or the mental or whatever to chase freelance journalism.
Yeah.
So yeah, I have that.
Okay. And what's that business called?
It's my name actually. Now it's still sort of informal. I haven't formally registered it quite yet. But so far I've worked with Nigerian Venice. I don't know if the Venice. I don't know if Venice Biennale is kind of like it's the biggest art exhibition in the world. So Nigeria was showing there for the first time. So I worked on the communications team for that. The Future Awards Africa led up communications for that as well. A foundation, there's a couple of art foundations in Nigeria that I work with as well. So people that I've kind of like worked with. I just call it IO Digital Squad Communications Consultancy, ARC, with AC. But not quite, you know, formal yet.
Okay.
Anyway.
Well, that's still interesting. All right. So we've kind of covered a little bit about the business, and now we want to know a little bit more about you as an entrepreneur. So what fires you up in the morning? What's your morning routine, and why is that routine so important to you?
My morning routine is reading, because reading just sort of, I don't know, it wakes me up when I'm reading text. I think very well, maybe because I'm a writer. So when I wake up in the morning, the first thing I open my, before I even pray sometimes, I open my Twitter, my Flipboard, or my pockets, any saved link that I've had, I would read, or Google Now, I'd read like the first 3, 4, 5 things that pop up. That's what I do every morning. And that just sort of gets me going. It just sort of gives me, I don't know. It sort of gives me like a structure or what's to come during the day, which is most likely I'll probably be writing or thinking about writing or researching or planning to write. So reading good work, hopefully, so puts me in that frame of mind.
Mm.
Yeah.
Okay, nice. And so, I mean, being an entrepreneur and being sort of this freelance person, I think you're more an entrepreneur than a lot of entrepreneurs because you go through that sort of constant struggle of pitching and all of that. So I want you to take us to a moment where you had probably one of your worst times. We call it the down times here at the Bandits, Knowledge Bandits. But take us to that moment. What did it feel like? Just help us understand the emotions that were running through you at the time.
Which is a really interesting question because that moment for me is, for now anyway, it's enduring. So I have weeks. So I think it happened actually like the most recent one I can remember 2 weeks ago where I had sent all these pitches maybe last year or the first of January. And throughout that week, I was getting rejections. Throughout, like almost every day, like, no, it's a good idea, but no. So So the following week after, I couldn't do any work at all.
Yeah.
it's what it does for me. Well, in my own experience, that it's so no matter how it, even if just the week before I got published by, which has happened, you know, before I got published by CNN and I got like a great review, but it sows such a damaging doubt, like, it's basically those things that basically tell me that this is not worth it. You are not good enough. You shouldn't be doing this. Get a full-time job. You know, and doubt is crippling. Like it's really hard to express or to explain how crippling doubt is. Like when, you know, you read an email that basically says, oh, this is good, but it's not good enough. Or no, we don't want this. Essentially, we don't want you. Or maybe you're not good enough. You know, it's So, so that week, the following week, I think I was just in bed mostly throughout and I was watching Netflix.
Wow.
I was just trying to, and I have to like, again, then psych myself up and be like, well, you know what, like, but I have done like some great things, like, you know, not that long ago, you know, I'm doing this great fellowship right now. Like I wouldn't have gotten in if I wasn't good enough. Mm-hmm. You know, you just have to, again, sort of count the achievements and weigh them against, oh, this is just a blip in the road. And, you know, the no's will come. People always say, like, you know, it gets easier. But I don't think no matter how successful you get, like, rejections are, which is, like, something that you cannot avoid in this business. And you get rejected, you know. And it's one thing to, you know, which I guess is different, I guess, maybe for other businesses, to maybe pitch for, like, maybe one, I don't know how, you know, I can't speak for other businesses. Well, maybe 1 month, you have a huge pitch. To get rejected, but to get rejected like 6 times in 1 week, it does happen to you. So yeah, that was that. Hmm. That was quite something, and it took some guessing.
Over. Yeah, and I know for entrepreneurs, the rejections you receive are typically more than the yeses that you hear. But it seems like in journalism, it's almost expected that you'll receive many, many rejections before you receive any yes or any interest at all.
Yes.
I mean, I guess there's an element of just human resiliency that allows you to keep going. Your passion for writing, your passion for digging up information keeps you going. But for people who are trying to get started in that, who are still trying to figure things out, what advice can you give them in terms of getting started as a freelance journalist?
So the first thing I would say is don't start as a freelance journalist. Like I feel like you need to have a base. So you need to have, you know, like you need to work. If the goal is journalism, eventually start in a formal 9-to-5-ish. You're turning in 3 pieces a week. It gets on Saturday at the end of the month and then build from there. So first of all, it helps you just like, you know, it builds. So it's building blocks, right? So you there in a typical newspaper house, you can meet the president today. You meet somebody, an interesting, I don't know, cleaner tomorrow. Like you build contacts from there, right? And also you can also have that, you also build that sort of, when I say steal, that you know that, you know, you have been somewhere where you're putting in work and your work was constantly being published, right? And also, when you are then freelancing, those are the things that you put forward. Nobody will hire you off of, oh, I'm a great writer, I think I can do this for you. No, people want to know you have done before. That's so important. So if you build a cache of work in a formal, you know, like in a steady paying, I don't know, whatever, media house, you can then build from there and say you want to become a freelancer. But I would not, I think it would be foolish to start out in journalism as a freelancer. Like, I don't know anyone that has done it.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe they have, but like, I just think the best bet is just start somewhere first.
Okay.
Just build lineup, build contacts, build the network, build a repertoire of work, and then go from there. And also just build that confidence as well. That confidence is so important. The confidence that will keep you when you start getting the rejections.
Yeah. Yeah. And so we talked about resiliency as a trait that's important for all entrepreneurs, but it's seeming like for journalism, it's really important there. But what other traits do you think people need to have to be able to succeed in journalism?
You need to be a voracious reader. And like when I say it's not just reading books, or it's not just reading, and definitely not reading motivational books, which Nigerians tend to get it twisted.
Mm.
That reading motivational books, reading, you need to read everything. Like, you need to read, for instance, I have an intense loathing for numbers, but I'm going to read Bloomberg because, you know, who knows when, you know, that knowledge might be, because, and no knowledge is lost. No knowledge is useless. Like, everything is useful. It all comes together subconsciously sometimes when you're writing. I think that happened to me. Like, when I'm writing, A sentence comes out from nowhere, and I'm like, oh, where did that come from? That's probably something I've heard or I've read before. That just played out on the page, right? You need to read as widely as possible. You need to learn to see beyond. So someone says, oh, you know, or which is very common, like here, like in Lagos, where I'm based, Nigeria, like, oh, Lagos State celebrates the launch of, 10 entertainment centers, so it starts, it's a feel-good story, right? Like, it looks, oh, it's fantastic, you know, Lagos is developing. But if you read, just let's read beyond the headline, as you just ask, to just be more curious. But then find out that, oh, to get those 10 entertainment centers, 300,000 people had to be kicked out of their houses, and their houses were demolished. Right? But you will not see that in the paper.
Yeah.
You know, but you need to be skeptical, especially if you're a journalist in a country like Nigeria. And I guess, to be honest, quite even in the US as well, because now that the US is in the post-truth age, you need to be skeptical of everything. Like, you need to just take things. I mean, of course, it's a bit of a balance. So skeptical, but not cynical per se. Like, don't doubt entirely everything, but just, you know, just keep a clearer, more open eye. Like, when things look, you know, too good to be true, they probably are, you know, right? So it's just literally just, just especially like in actually on any country on the African continent, to be quite honest.
Yeah.
So reading widely, skepticism, and also reading also helps. Sometimes people don't realize that. So you need to be able to identify, which is also can be hard sometimes, is sort of specializing. Journalists who are specialists in this industry tend to go further. So, for instance, Ta-Nehisi Coates is known for being the authority on race because he has focused like his energies and his work on that field. You know, he has honed it. And when it comes up, you know, when that matter comes up, is the one person that people think of.
Yeah.
You could decide to go down that route and, you know, find something. And this honestly takes a while to figure out. Like, find something that you're really, really deeply passionate about, that either that you care deeply about or that makes you angry, or both. You know, I find like you can always write from a good place from when it comes to those two things. That is a good way, you know, and then you'll be known for that. So people will look for you. And that way, stories will come to you sometimes. They even look for the story. So when something happens, so use myself as an example. So I mentioned Lagos quite a bit. I'm from Lagos. I'm like, both my parents are from here. I'm quite passionate about Lagos and Lagos is developing. I don't think, even though a lot of people think Lagos is this place that's developing at a fast rate, I don't think that at all. So I write about Lagos quite often.
Okay.
Right. And I found like recently people just reach out, like when they see something, like, want something to do with Lagos, they'll send me like links or send me like books or stories, you know, and that's like, I don't prompt that, but just because I guess they've seen that, oh, this guy, you know, write quite a bit about Lagos, he might be interested in this, you know, so they push that like to me. So yeah, that's also something to think about off the top of my head. Yeah. Right. Like,
okay.
Sort of, the ingredients.
Yeah. And I mean, just sort of, as you were talking, it just sparked a question in my mind. So I've heard stories of journalists or even subject matter experts being offered large amounts of money to fabricate stories. How do you steer clear of, sort of tarnishing the integrity of your work as you're moving? And have you experienced that? And how do you navigate that?
That's a really interesting question. You just do, I guess. I suppose, so it's, I guess it's, for me, it's always a, come to me with that. It's a question of, like, what matters to you more? Is it the instant gratification of a large check or continuing to build a career for chasing the truth? That's just, to me, I mean, it's as simple as that, really. That probably happens a lot. Mm-hmm. In Nigeria, has it happened to me? No, I don't think, I haven't been, you know, to fabricate a story. No, that hasn't, I haven't personally had that experience. But I know, yeah, it is rampant here, especially because you find that newspapers are owned by politicians. So
yeah.
Then it really is like, sometimes it's not even seen as fabrication. It's seen as you answering an order. So when the publisher says, oh, you know what? 10 people died here, but I want you to say nobody died. He's paying your salary. So, like, I don't know that. So then it gets trickier, more complex. So while, of course, you might even be a you know, honest man, you want to choose the truth, blah, blah, blah. But at the same time, you have to wait somebody who is in, like, has the keys to your means to make a living. So that gets really tricky. But if you're not in that, you know, that position, I guess it just comes down to those two questions. Is it the instant gratification of the money, or just like if you care deeply enough about like your career, really? Because the thing is, one, it takes the one thing. Like, because for journalism, as a part of literally like your stock in trade is the truth. Like, you're known for it. I mean, that's literally your job, just as how, I don't know, an Uber driver's main tool is a map. Mm-hmm. Yours is telling the truth. So if then comes the question that you can't do that, then you can no longer like be trusted or be seen as a journalist. So yeah. So I don't, that would be my, you know, my answer to that.
Okay. Yeah. And sort of again, off of that, you talked to journalists specifically saying that they need to be skeptical. And I think actually for readers, that's deeply important too, is when you read something, is be skeptical, because if there are a lot of stories out there that are fabricated, you need to be skeptical. But I want to ask, because you have an insider's perspective of what's going on, so how, as the reader, should we treat misinformation, and how do we sort of push to get that to get rid of that in the industry?
So I think, so for readers today worldwide, it's not enough to I guess sometimes my stories come out people debating themselves on Twitter, on Facebook, or everywhere, as opposed to directing the questions to the paper or to journalists that wrote the story. So I think, look, so if you have questions, if you have concerns, if you have doubts, if you have, so the reader, if a reader also cares about the truth, is to direct their energies to the source, basically. So I think the more readers start to do that, the more papers will, because papers know increasingly that if we sidestep, if we say something, we will be found out, I think they will behave better, right? And there will be maybe less inclination, even though that will still not stop the bribers from writing trash, but there might be less inclination to, you know, to skirt or to or to dress up or to, you know, to water down the truth, whatever.
I think
readers should like take to, you know, just point out, you know, something happened, something, a breaking story, like I'll give an example recently that happened with the New York Times. The New York Times had done this huge, in my opinion, frankly needless piece about the far right, white supremacists, mm-hmm. and why they hate blacks, and you know, how, why they voted Trump. And they, it was written in such a way that it was almost sympathetic and approving of what people said, what they were doing. In the piece at all, there was no, the journalist, which I thought was quite, you know, for New York Times, the journalist did not include any objections. It did not include, like, it was not balanced, basically. And I remember that piece, I can't remember who wrote it now, it caused such an uproar with people directly asking questions of NYT, criticizing them over the course of, like, I think a day or 2 days. Heavily enough that it caused them, which I think was very telling, for them to then defend themselves in an editorial saying, oh, you know, the far right is a group that wasn't even heard enough of, that deserves to be heard, blah, blah. But to me, that was telling that obviously they were paying attention. So, and that was only because the reader directed people were canceling their subscriptions, you know, that one, there's a consequence for, you know, for that. But that took, you know, the readers, you know, taking the initiative to not just debate it among themselves, but debate it and call out the publication and the journalists as well, asking questions, why was this written this way? Why couldn't it have been better done? I think there was even a particular reader who wrote a long, fantastic thread as to how that piece could have been better done. You know, which is like, so your readers have power and like intelligent. So you need to just, you know, seize that.
Yeah.
Right. So I mean, yeah, and that reaction just proves to me that, yeah, I mean, when readers hold, you know, hold the journalists and the publication accountable, then there might be less misinformation or less, you know, this, again, in post-truth thing, where people are, you know, like, presenting things seemingly innocently for their more sinister undertones.
Yeah. Okay. And you briefly touched on, when you touched on the piece with the New York Times, you said it wasn't a balanced article. So what, I guess from a journalist, what is the recipe for a good piece?
The recipe for a good piece is really just, if you're right, if it's not an opinion piece and if it's reportage, like you're saying, this happened, he said, she said, remove yourself from the story. Let the reader come to the conclusion themselves. So when there's a story where there are obviously 2, 3, 4 sides, a good piece hears out all those sides. Whether it's a long read, whether it's a short story, whatever it is, right? Like, even if you have, and journalists, I sometimes, when I write some things, maybe I write about an injustice, I write about like a developmental issue, of course, I have opinions and I have strong feelings about what should be or what should be the right thing. But no, like, so even if, so let's say, I don't know, like a particular area hasn't had power for 10 years, right? Of course, I'm going to document the people's pain and what has cost them, people that live in that area. I'm also going to ask the power authority and the officials as to how come, you know, this has been the case, if there's a justifiable reason why. And not just, even though in my heart of hearts, I already assume it's the result of incompetence and they're bad and they're not functional and they should all be fired, blah, blah, blah. But their voice is still necessary for the story to be balanced, for the story to be objective, for the story to be, you know, to make sure all sides are heard. So I think that's a very, very, you know, but that makes a good piece. I think that makes a good piece, which is literally dead here in Nigeria, unfortunately. It's just the writing. So something that I particularly care about. So because I have a bit of a, I don't know, fiction background, there's a way you can write news, you can write about serious things, you can write about sad things in a way that it evokes emotion or evokes engagement or evokes, you know, a kind of like visceral reaction, which I think should always be the aim when you're writing, because you're not just writing to just fill space, which I think you do that here. So you want people who read it to be able to take away something from it, not necessarily even a lesson, but to either, or to be able to be informed, to be entertained, or, you know, just take away something, something hopefully, you know, emotional, right? So I am a huge believer in, like, sort of using, you know, literary fiction devices to write journalism, like to write it like a story that you read in a, I don't know, in a fiction piece or in a book or in a novel that was fiction. I feel like it does better service the story, and it's just depending as well as what you want to get out of it. If writing a story about why, you know, the kids in slums don't have education, I want it to be, you know, to be emotionally alive enough that even if somebody who was in position to something about it read it, felt compelled because of the what was depicted, what was said, how it was said, you know, to do something, to take action. I think that's really, really important when, you know, when we write as well. But those two things, objectivity and like sort of more stylistic consideration when you're writing.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. I mean, a lot of great pieces of advice you gave. There are a lot of great nuggets that you dropped. One thing I do want to highlight is you said you need to be able to remove yourself from the piece when you're writing it. Mm. And that's this element of being objective. And I think whether it's in journalism, whether it's starting a tech business, whatever you're doing, we're just going through your daily life. It's important to be objective. Oftentimes you find, and I sort of like to think of it, the far right in the US, the far right has ideas that are just as radical as the far left. If you really think about it, both of these sides are polarized and they're not thinking objectively. But the, I guess the most important thing, a comedian once said, the problem with the world is that everyone has democracy and they think democracy means that they get their way. But democracy actually means that sometimes you don't get your way, but you can think objectively through it and understand why your way didn't push through
work
that time.
I agree. Yeah. I agree with that entirely.
And so we've almost completely abandoned the script for Knowledge Bandits, but I think it's great. I was talking with an Uber driver not too long ago. I mean, this guy is from, I believe he was from Ethiopia. He was a scholar in Ethiopia. He was a professor. And we were talking a little bit about the podcast. And he was like, you know what I would suggest to you? He said, interview writers, because writers are the people who shape, they shape the minds of a generation. So highlight writers who are doing great work. And I thought, I mean, when you think of writing pieces, some of the greatest, you think of some of the greatest authors, you can see how they've inspired film, and almost all other forms of entertainment. Words are extremely powerful. So, I think that it's important that we highlight, a lot of people like you who are doing great work trying to push the truth forward. And also, so, I mean, you've had difficult times. You said, you sent out pieces and people just didn't seem interested and that kind of put you in a funk for a week. But, now I want to shift gears and go to a time where you felt like, wow, you're on top of the world. This is actually what you need to be doing. This is the right place to be.
Okay. Good times. I think this happened twice in recent memory. The most recent one was when I wrote this, I was commissioned, you know, by, so CNN has an original series called Parts Unknown that's hosted by Anthony Bourdain. So they were doing an episode on Lagos, and I love writing about Lagos.
Yeah.
So they had commissioned a piece about Area Boys. I don't know if you're familiar with that. So yeah, Area Boys or Agbiros, for those who don't know, are like these these street guys that who don't necessarily they don't have jobs, but they somehow out of either violence, bullying, harassment, you know, attacks. People And they are also have an association where they are sort of connected to the transportation system in Lagos, because Lagos's transportation sector is mostly informal and is run by kingpins and lords and whatever. Anyway, so these area boys can be, they're a huge part of Lagos' character. And they can be very powerful. Like, they would stop, buses from moving on the roads. They will slash tires. They will do all kinds of things. Anyway, but they've been this maligned group for like a long time with good reason. But I guess nobody had ever really I'd never seen them be humanized. Like, how they became area boys, why they would choose that kind of like sort of rough lifestyle, to put it mildly. What dreams do they have growing up? What were the ambitions? Blah, blah, blah. So, CNN piece, had me do this. And this was probably the scariest thing, because I remember going to, there's a sort of a stronghold, well, not a stronghold, but an area in Lagos where there's a lot of them, which is Lagos Island. And I remember going in there by myself, and just like talking to these people who at the time were apparently, I learned after the interview that they were actually armed, that they had guns. Well, I didn't know that at the time. So I basically wrote this piece, about them, and about their lives. And to be honest, when I wrote it, I thought, it was an interesting piece. I enjoyed writing it. But when it was published, I didn't think it had such a huge, there was such a huge, the only positive reaction to it is that it was completely, took me by surprise, but really validated, I was like, this is what I want to do for the rest of my life. It's telling a story that was right there in plain sight that nobody had thought of telling, or I just maybe not told, maybe the way that I did it and stuff, at risk of sounding modest. And just having it, and this is such a strong reaction in people saying, oh, I didn't know that about area boys, or I didn't know that, they became area boys. I mean, the reason why the phenomenon exists was because of a weird and obscure economic policy in the 80s, that almost eviscerated Nigerian economy. All these backstories that nobody talks about. People talk about the present problem, that I was able to, shed a kind of light of understanding, or to make people, empathize or appreciate them better, or people who even know that they are not just on the roads, shouting at people or screaming or threatening people just because they want to, or because they don't have a choice. They are surviving. They're being resilient. Basically, like me, that same pictures every day. We're no different. So just being able to capture that complexity and seeing the positive reaction to it. That was huge. Also, last year when I was accepted into a media fellowship, I think I mentioned that earlier, a data and the investigative journalism fellowship. And I must say, before I was accepted into that particular fellowship, I'd applied 1,000 times. I'm not even kidding. I applied 1,000 times to different ones, locally, abroad, and I had never gotten accepted. So that was good. So that it was good to sort of get that, so your work is worth amplifying, is worth, investing in, because fellowships are sort of they pay you to write, they expose you to this incredible network of people who can tell about stories, they give you the resources, So yeah, those two things that happened in the past 6 months are quite, giving me a reason to keep going.
Nice. Well, a lot of great information. I'm really just overwhelmed. This is the first time I've talked with a writer, but I definitely understand what that Uber driver was talking about, is that the way you look at the world is profoundly different from the way other people might look at it, because you are observing, and you're observing with the purpose to write about it and to reflect that to everyone else. So I think there's definitely a different way that you think comparative to many other people. And with that,
I'll take you.
and with that, we're going to go into the rapid fire round. Are you ready?
Sure.
All right.
No problem.
What do you think was stopping you from taking the step into being a freelance journalist?
Fear, I think, because I thought maybe I couldn't do it. I thought maybe I wasn't good enough. I thought maybe the kind of things I was interested in writing, nobody was interested in reading, but that has since changed.
And when did you stop looking at the work you're doing now as just a hobby or something that you were testing out and more as an actual career path?
Very recently, I would say, I think maybe 2016, maybe, when I just felt, or even maybe last year, when I just thought, I think the fellowship kind of helped with that. And I just thought, you know, I'm going to be doing this for the rest of my life. And I've chosen to do this for like, and I'm okay with doing this for the rest of my life. Mm. You know, just getting kind of validation. And okay, well, 2015 as well. So I was in a creative writing workshop with Chimamanda Adichie.
Oh wow!
And being accepted into that as well was also quite good. That's what I think. Okay, so let's 2015 when I thought like, you know, this could actually be a thing that I could do, you know, for the rest of my life. Yeah.
Wow, nice. And what would you say is your superpower as a journalist?
My superpower as a journalist is description. So I have the thing where I will, so if I, which is also, it's a good thing. It's a good thing that can also be a curse. So when I have a word count, let's say I have a 1,000 word count, I could spend 500 describing a place, a person, a thing, just so that when you're reading it, I feel like I have taken you there or you saw it the way I saw it in that moment. I think that's my superpower as a journalist. And what I, but sometimes it's not really good because like, anybody had time. So, yeah, people's time and short, so people should just read. Okay, well, yeah, say that. Yeah.
Okay. What quality do you wish to improve on most?
Patience. Maybe. For somebody whose work is observing and digging deep, I can be very dismissive at times. Depending on something that I feel like, you know, doesn't drive the conversation forward, it doesn't do anything. But I think I could definitely do with, you know, being more quiet in the moment and just, you know, absorbing things more before, like, you know, moving on.
And what's the best advice you've received and who is it from?
The best advice I received, I think I mentioned it earlier. So it's, I think the best advice of you is, it's, it's really cool. From like a person that told me,
or something you read.
Sorry, something I read. It's something I read. Yeah, I think I said it earlier. Like the best advice is also the best quotes. Just do what you have to do. You can do what you want to. It's just basically saying that, you know, like everything that goes to fall in place as that's when, you know, or how exactly you want it. But you just need to just stay the course. And something that's been said maybe a lot, but I didn't appreciate it. One of the reasons is trust in the process. You know, it's only because, I'm trying to make a real life example, but I can't remember. But yeah, just like things could start small. So for instance, I'll use an example for me. So the CNN piece that I did like later in the year came from an earlier piece I had done for another platform that was about Lagos. Like it was about like a travel, it was a small travel piece. I didn't think it was anything interesting, but somebody like an editor had seen that piece and then commissioned for this bigger piece. Right. So you don't know where the connection would click. You don't know where it's going to come from. So just trust the process. Just trust that like everything, every small thing is leading up, seemingly small to you now is leading up to a big thing. Now that thing was small to me 10 months ago, but it's big to me now because it led to this big thing, you know, but yeah, trust the process and do what you have to do. You can do what you want to.
Nice. Yeah. And what are you reading now?
I just finished reading Fela, This Bitch of a Life. Because I don't know that part of the question, but because is this autobiography on biography on Fela's life. I'm writing a piece on Fela's wives, who I think have been completely erased from popular culture, even though they were a huge part of why we love and know Fela to be the man he is today. But the women who danced behind him, women who were his wives, were dancers, DJs. His mistresses at times. So that's what I was reading. But that was also kind of unmasking and learning more about the man and how he came to be. Yeah.
And I love Fela. And off of that, I think very often Tony Allen, his drummer, is overlooked a little bit. And he's the one who really codified that sound that you associate with Fela.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, a lot of untold stories around the man.
Yeah, definitely. So what is one internet resource or application that you couldn't live without?
WhatsApp. WhatsApp. Only because I really don't enjoy calls. It's really weird. I don't like, which is also, yeah, it's a weird thing for my job, because I always have to like call people to like confirm things, you know, sources and like that. But I prefer to just type. I'm so used to writing like my fingers, my hands. I just feel like more productive when I'm doing that. So when I'm on the phone, it's like, ugh. So yeah, WhatsApp, sure.
Nice. And what do you do to unwind from a hectic schedule?
I dance, I think. So I'm really huge on work-life balance. Like yesterday, for instance, I had a long day yesterday that finished around 10 o'clock. So today, I know this is doing anything else like 4. So either like I just give myself like space of time in between when I'm not doing anything and not feeling guilty for it, because that's also a huge thing when you work for yourself. Like, you can feel like every free time you should be working, you should be closing something, you should be chasing an email. But yeah, you know, just like that. So either I would dance, I would, yeah, maybe watch Mulan cartoons.
That sounds like a fun time. And to close out the round, and to close out the rapid fire round, do you feel like you've made it yet?
No, not by a mile. No. I mean, that's a weird question. No, I don't think so. I don't know that I ever would. I mean, of course, like, I guess there will come a time, hopefully very soon, where I'm sort of like more comfortable. I feel like, okay, you know what? Like, I haven't done so badly for myself, but I don't know. Like, I'm constantly seeking to outdo myself. So if I made it last week, 3 days later, I might feel like, oh yeah, that wasn't that great. You know, you need to do something better. You know, I mean, I get what you mean. Your question means like as a whole, but I don't feel like I've made it yet. No. Okay. And I just feel like that's it's ongoing. But I don't think so.
Well, and that concludes the rapid fire round. I think you did a great job. Very concise answers. And as we cool down, I want to know, what is one book? I'm sure you have tons of books in your mind. And I guess since you're a writer, I'll give you between 1 and 3 books that you can recommend to the listeners.
Just like any kind of book?
Yeah.
At all? So one book I haven't read it yet, but I read it in its entirety yet, but I read part of it. And I can recommend for anyone who's actually interested in like knowing about Nigeria or just Nigerianism or just like, of course, I mean, we're the most populous Black country on the continent, so you should be interested. Anyway, it's a book called +234, An Awkward Guide to Be Nigerian. By a columnist, a Belenja columnist, and a colleague of mine called Atoke. I think it's available on Amazon. It was a 3-year long column that was formed into a book. And I read part of the column. It's quite, it digs really deeper into the things that you read about from the outside looking at Nigeria, even about ourselves that you don't really consider. Things about, you know, culture, religion, or religiosity, as it were, like all those things. It goes beyond the surface. I really like that book. Another book I would recommend is, gosh, I read so many books this year alone. I'm reading another book I'm reading right now. I'm a Nigerian book, but Ta-Nehisi Coates.
Okay.
We're 8 years in power. Like, I'm reading it right now, and even though I'm not, you know, I'm not African American, but like, that man's a god when it comes to writing. So, I think everybody should read that. If you're of African descent anywhere you are in the world, you should read it. And if you're white, you should read it. So that makes it Muslim. That's everybody. Maybe. It's a very powerful book. The third book I would recommend would probably be Love Does Not Win Elections.
Okay.
by a Nigerian author as well, Aisha Osori. So basically, also another deep dive into Nigeria's very, 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 very dirty electoral system. It's you would think anyone who read it, even a Nigerian that was familiar, would be shocked as to how much work we have to do as a country.
Okay.
I love those.
So just to make sure I get it right, the first one, Plus 234, An Upward Guide to Being a Nigerian.
Mm-hmm. To Being Nigerian, yeah, okay. By Atoke. The author's name is Atoke. Yeah.
And we were 8 years in power, and then Love Does Not Win Elections.
Love Does Not Win Elections, yeah.
Okay. And for anyone that's listening, we'll put those links up on Ayodeji's page on the site so you have easier access to it. We'll send you a link to where to buy it, all that stuff. So, feel free to go on the website and check that out. I think you touched on this a little bit, but can you speak on sort of the value of mentorship and who your mentors are?
This is a bit of a tricky topic because I don't know that. So I think mentorship is very valuable. I think mentorship is valuable when the mentor is not only interested in your professional advancement, but in just, I don't know, being a better human being. I think mentorship is valuable when it is, which is really difficult, when it is altruistic, it's entirely selfless. It's not like you're necessarily preparing the person to then be useful to you later, which is really difficult because, I mean, we're human beings. You always, you know, find a way to, you know, to cash back, so to speak. Personally, in my experience, I haven't had a direct mentor per se. So I guess in my way, I observe and take lessons out of, you know, my relationships with like people. I think a huge mentor from, I guess in that sense, a huge mentor from you would be my dad. Mm. My dad's like a career public civil servant. And just, you know, longevity, keeping at something, which is something I guess it's more increasingly difficult for young people, is to just stay with the one thing. And, you know, it's good to be, you know, we all like to, like in Nigeria, we like to hustle and do like 10 different things because we're all trying to make it. And the goal is money instead of, you know, fulfillment or happiness or which things are equally more important. So he, you know, like, you know, just following his life, you know, as a career professor. My dad is my mentor, not in the strict sense of the word, but having observed a whole career in that he has been a career civil servant. So just sort of dedication, commitment, and everything that just one thing, just a career. Which I feel is increasingly difficult these days because we young people were trying to do like 10, you know, any number of things, you know, to make it, to become successful or chasing, you know, money and cars and houses, which is great, but like as opposed to the detriment of fulfillment or detriment of happiness, detriment of specializing and becoming an expert in one thing. So following his example has been an inspiration for me. Another mentor from afar or maybe closer has been like the first person who gave me a communications job, which is a dear missionary who I worked with on Nigeria and Venice and she runs a gallery in Lagos and Securita. Just seeing how someone who rose above immense difficulties, I guess, to become, to do as what she does now, and in such a niche, a niche and fairly unappreciated, you know, field, which is art, visual arts. You know, she basically sells, you know, she runs a gallery, you know, sort of building a culture of people collecting art, promoting art, you know, which I also, it's a reference for me as well, because people still, till today, as much as, you know, like you said, the Ethiopian Uber driver scholar said, who appreciates and probably understands the power of writing, he's the minority. Most people don't. And most people undervalue it as well, even professionally, you know. So just seeing somebody strike out, you know, against all those odds, you know, has a set of example for me as well, you know, to follow. Yeah, so I'll say those off the top of my head, but I personally, I would say as well, just I have a weird, just because of what I've seen here, I know mentors can be crucial and instrumental to people's success, but I'm also kind of, there's something I'm also quite skeptical about as well still. But yeah, I would say those are my two examples, and that's kind of the value.
Okay. And what advice would you give to someone who's listening, who is on the fence of trying to, I guess, stepping into journalism professionally? What advice would you give that person?
First thing I would say is, like, you need to figure out and be honest with yourself as to why you want to do it. So you need to be, it could be that you have an affinity for the media, you really like writing, which is, well, all great, but like obviously also to sort of consider the costs that come with it. Like the cost can be, if you're Nigerian at least, you might never buy a Lamborghini. That's a very real, but like you're not going to do it, like it's not going to affect you, even though like it could. Probably not a Lamborghini. I mean, you could rise up to the point where you have a decent, you know, comfortable life. But you're definitely not going to do it. So money cannot be, you know, or riches, or, you know, just financial reason cannot just be your at least your driving point, or your reason. So it might be also be cool to sort of consider, like, sort of ask, not necessarily a different, and this might sort of go against what I said earlier about focusing on one thing. What I do, for instance, the communications part of the business that I run is still quite connected to what I do in journalism, because it's still at the heart of it, it's still basically writing, right? It's still writing. So you might want to consider, like, you know, how you can find a balance. You know, if I guess in journalism, like, what is something that you can do, that you can manage, you know, that can sort of keep you, you know, after selling and doing, depending kind of life that you have or whatever. Also kind of think about as well, the kind of topics you're interested in. Again, I have to say this is a disclaimer. This takes some time. It takes a while to figure out. It will not happen overnight that you figure out what you like, what you enjoy writing about. You know, even after figuring it out, to be honest, some things that I didn't think might interest me today. You know, I'm for instance, at the moment, I'm writing a story about about tax, and tax is something that I would never have thought maybe even a month ago that I would have any interest in, but something that, you know, that's interesting me now, and I'm, you know, thinking of writing about. To just be very it's just very present, just be very open as well. What you're figuring out, be open as well to mistakes, be open to try new things, trying different topics, and just seeing, filling them out, you know, see what you enjoy, see if it's, you know, you like watching sports, so that could be sports writing the thing. Maybe you like, you know, politics, you know, seeing opinion pieces, commentary, reports on politics, analysis, that could also be a thing as well. And to not just downplay anything at all. And your specialty can come from anywhere. It can come from the most obscure interest that you have and make it like your thing. I'll give an example, which isn't necessarily journalism, but there's an interesting gentleman like in Lagos who has made it, you know, a thing to look at colonial buildings in old parts of Lagos. Those buildings had been there for years. Nobody thought he could actually make a business out of like touring, just like learning their histories, learning the families that lived in them, learning how the Brazilians, you know, moved back, you know, all those things. And he has made it a business now. You know, just something that was just came out of just a random interest, you know, and the same way you can, you know, the interest about learning about history can come, I can become, you know, an expert in that, you know, just paying attention to all those things, you know, is this a thing that will eventually stand you out for sure, you know, like your style, or either it's your style, the way you write it, or what you're writing. And those two things are very, very important as well. Honing those two things, especially style, which I feel people don't pay attention enough to. Like, you need, as much as you're writing about how, I don't know, some scandalous story or whatever, story could be great, you know, which is, I mean, yeah, I think people focus more on the story or on how it's written. I think paying attention to how it's written, because the major thing is the writing. If you become a journalist, that is the major ingredient. Interest, whatever, that is still the heart and soul of what that you're doing. So that should be the thing you focus on the most. Learning how to be better at it. Whether it's, you know, reading widely, like I said earlier, reading widely, reading the best magazines, reading the best newspapers. Like I read, for instance, I read NYT, I read Vanity Fair, I read the Washington Post. I'm reading widely. Like I would say from there, I can read, you know, BuzzFeed, I can read NicoleBeachy.com, I can read Paris Hilton. Like it can come from, you know, from everywhere. Like, and as a, in a nutshell, that's it.
And for you, as we're almost closing down, but I just thought to ask this question. How much of your writing skills do you attribute to natural ability, and what percentage do you attribute to actually practicing your craft?
I think it's 50-50. I think it's the internal question, can writing be taught? I personally don't think so. But it's something you can get better. I think to a certain degree, everybody can write. But natural ability, not everybody has it in equal measure. But learning, or the resources to learn, everybody has access to that. So while I might have been born a good writer, but what will make me a great writer is practice and reading and learning and, you know, and stuff and things like that. I think it's a bit of both. I think for me personally, I would say I think more right now, more of it definitely comes from practicing and reading, and, you know, just reading the right, reading, you know, things, reading to find out what you like, reading as a writer, where you are sort of imbibing styles and, you know, little quips and little tricks, you know. That makes my writing better. Like the way I used to write when I was building on natural ability 5 years ago, not the way I write now. My writing has changed a lot. So then, like, as in back then, I wasn't so, for instance, if you had asked me 5 years ago what was my superpower, I'm definitely going to tell you description, because I didn't care about description back then. For me, description was not a thing, but now it is. And who knows, description will always be a thing. But yeah, so I think it's more practice. And practice, as in, and reading good writing. Yeah. Those two.
Yeah. Nice. And unfortunately, we've sort of come to the end of the podcast. We've come to the end of the show. And as we're about to leave, how can people connect with you via Twitter, Instagram, website, email? And also, where can they find your writing?
You can find I'm currently working on a website. It's ready soon. But otherwise, my writing typically goes on my Twitter, which is my name, Aide Jirotinwa. I post on my Instagram as well. If you search Aide Jirotinwa, my profile should come up. But my Instagram handle sounds better. Page. I post on my LinkedIn as well. Aide Jirotinwa as well. Post my writing there as well. So they can connect with me there. As regards, my email is aidejirotinwa@gmail.com. my name's on everything. Nice. Reach out to me for story ideas, for, I don't know, advice, if you have any, or commissions, whatever it is. Yeah, that is a great way to reach out. But Twitter, I'm very active,
and it's weird. Okay, great. And as we're about to leave, I'm going to ask a bit of a unique question also, but can you share a piece of parting wisdom with us? And also, how can people support, maybe it's you, if we want to support you as a writer, or if we want to...
Hey, if you're still there, thanks for listening. If you like the show, please hit that subscribe button wherever you listen to podcasts and follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Handle is Knowledge Bandits everywhere. We have closed sessions lined up with some of the entrepreneurs that we've already interviewed. So if you have questions that weren't answered during the show, you'll have a chance to connect with them during these closed sessions. Just go to the Knowledge Bandits website at knowledgebandits.com and sign up for the newsletter on the contact page. If you or someone you know has a business, we'd love to share your story with the Knowledge Bandits community. Just send an email to interview@knowledgebandits.com. If you have a question for me or you want to connect with any of the guests so far, send an email to me personally at arum@knowledgebandits.com. Finally, if you love music and you have a few moments, please listen to Guru by Classic and MI.
I pass a mood. Now for the feel I want to do. I didn't want to give a suck kudu. Bow on the canoe had Germany. The boy just the boy like my Uru. Bass in a Ghani or Mark on the face when I Zani or competition. I take Adi or Bob in the mafia. Not my Adi or Benny. The flow slippery race in a Zami or Sinata Patti. A summon a shadi or Massapi or Jama. A Sinata Patti or Kama Sata Fawa. Munata Bali or Sinata with your skin. Sinata Shigeshi. Shigeshi. Because I'm with the LK. Yarn's like you and LK. And my turn, LK. I'm a move on with the LK. How lips cool down when I act in a senator. It's good. Mana, mana, boo, boo, sinna, sinna, boo. Mana, mana, boo, boo, sinna, boo. Mana, mana, boo, boo, sinna, boo. Mana, how yo, hey, sinna, I boo.
Classic. Gas care is difficult because house I'm not be new na so seba. I'm a hanker, listen, she wanna be yonder. Soon no shango te, soon a gulu. Come on, mirror, you're gonna school me. Come on, school me, you're gonna kill me. Muna, kashi, shinda, galona, zuwa, cypress. Harma, a chicken, male. Kukasa, akasa, fuskana. I can't call my number, the sucker shot. Oh my gosh, muna frosh, muna posh, bana rush, babu ruwa, muna loss. Shout out, man. Classic, soon a form, you see rappers, muna magani. I'm a daddy suit, say what in Baki the Karamani.
Sinata with your skin. Sinata she gets she gets. Sick of some of the LK. Yarn's like you and LK. And my turn like LK. I'm a move on with the LK. How a lips pull down when I act in a senator. It's good. Mana, mana, boo, boo, sinna, sinna, boo. Mana, mana, boo, boo, sinna, boo. Mana, mana, boo, boo. Classic and MI bag back with a bang, I don't look jeep. Nobody bother their father could fit to be. Get up, Zika, Gabu, Sina, Eho. Yo, verbal attack on the track, I'm a human go jeep. I'm a move on with the kid, okay? How lips cool down when I act in a senator kid.